been up since early in the a.m. working on a manuscript for a book that Brodmann will publish entitled For Those Who Fly Alone. And hopefully Frankie Schaefer will do the illustrations that go with it, at least the cover. For Those Who Fly Alone is a book about how to be a change agent within God's family. I have some real scars in my past that have come as a result of not knowing some of the things that I'm going to share with you this morning. I started the West Memorial Baptist Church with concepts that at the time differed wildly and not widely. And I discovered a year into it that the people were not capable, for the most part, of handling the radicalness of the change. And I showed, true to my Minnesota multiphasic that I was given at the Sunday School Board in a month of special preparation that I took before beginning the work in Houston, and I flaked out. I did not have the guts to take the pressure that came in playing the role of a change agent in a group of people. As a result, after 1 year at West Memorial, I resigned. And the church went into a time of great conflict, and I went into a time of deep depression. It probably took 2 years to really overcome the shock and the trauma of what I went through. And it took the church a year. I came back to that same church. I left it in September and came back in February, much the wiser, and began to avidly read everything I could get my hands on from every source that had anything to do with how to lead people through change. And so the things that I'm talking to you about this morning are not little Mickey Mouse things that I think will just fill a period of time in this seminar. I pray that I can help you become an effective change agent in these few moments. The best I can hope to do is just point your nose in the right direction, and that's terribly dangerous because this isn't enough time to really get into it in depth. And I would say in the beginning that after hearing all this today, if you're still determined that God wants you to effect change somewhere, for heaven's sake, don't think that you're an expert because of this. There are volumes and volumes and volumes written on the subject of how to take people through change. There are records in industry of million-dollar corporations that have gone bankrupt because brilliant men did not have enough sense to know how to handle change. And I also want you to know that I don't think I'm the world's greatest expert on this, and I may just rip my britches again within the next year, and if I do, you remember I said I told you so. Now with that background, let me just share these things that I just think would be helpful. The first principle is this, and we can title this Principles of Taking People Through Change. And the first principle is this. Who is starting all of this, you or God? Nothing is more important than that. Because if these ideas, these concepts, these visions, these dreams you have about taking change into something, whether it is major and radical like one of you have talked to me about at breakfast, or whether it is just a simple matter of dividing some Sunday school classes in a church that has not had such a division in 10 years of time. You really need to ask yourself the question, first of all, who started this? Is God leading me to do this? Is He really calling me to do this? Is this thing of the Lord? Because later on, when the pressure comes, if you're not sure who did start it, it's going to be mighty rugged to stay committed to it. And fear will overwhelm you. then you'll be in really serious trouble. And I would say the next principle is theology comes before methodology. And I mean that for you as a change agent, and I mean that for those that you are going to lead through change. Theology must come before the methodology. Methodology that does not naturally and normally flow from theology, from the teaching of the Word of God, is very dangerous. And so, work out the theological basis of what you're up to. Is it really a part of what God is doing in the Word, through the Word, and in the world around you? Now, once you've settled that, you have the stuff for the first part of being a change agent. And that is, without mentioning anything about the coming change, begin to present the theological basis which will automatically lead up to it. In whatever vehicle God gives you to do so, begin to share the theology behind the change. If for me it would be a pulpit, for you it might be a discipleship family. But somewhere the people you're going to be leading through change need to have the theological basis before you ever present the change to them. And so it might be a retreat or a series of retreats. Plant the concept in the heart and then give it time to germinate. And I would not move beyond this stage until at least somebody in the group comes and begins to filter back to me ideas, thoughts, suggestions, vibrations that make me recognize that this theology has gone beyond the intellectual state into the gut level of the person, where they're beginning now to say, I'm going to have to be living by what I'm learning. And if you do not have people that are theologically oriented, you're in trouble. That's where I made my big mistake in 1969 at West Memorial Baptist Church. I did not fully comprehend that. I wrote a paper, 68 pages long, explaining how we would go through our change. I gave it to the 38 members of the church before I ever went there as pastor. I said, I don't even want to know what salary you'll give me. Our whole family is prepared to work at secular jobs to support ourselves. I am coming to do what's in this book, in this 68-page book. And if you're committed to that and I'm committed to it, let's go. If not, I'm still looking for the place to begin an experimental church. And so they read it, and it sounded glamorous and exciting on paper, and it didn't sound very threatening because they didn't have to live in it, they just had to read about it. And I got into the church, and I decided that what we needed was a mighty revival after which we could really get moving. So I got the greatest speaker on revival that I had ever known, a man who had experienced it, Dr. Charles Culpepper from China, and I brought him in for a week in November. And Dr. Culpepper told about the great Shandong revival, and the power of God was upon the man, and I was just overwhelmed by the impact of what he said. And the third day he was with us, I slipped over into another corner of a church building that we had borrowed for that week. We had no buildings of our own, and Dr. Culpepper was not with us, and I turned to two of my key men and I said, isn't he fantastic? And I got clobbered. One of them was totally in opposition to what Culpepper was saying, called him a religious radical. And the other one said, my wife is the daughter of the president of the Baptist Convention in Alabama, and I've never heard anything like that in Baptist life in my whole life, and I'm wondering whether this is going to be a Baptist church or not. And right then I knew I was in trouble. But I wasn't smart enough to realize how big a trouble I was in. And it wasn't until the September after that, October, that I finally just checked out in total defeat. But that was the beginning of it. I did not plant an adequate theology in order that methodology would normally and honestly flow from the hearts of people who were being changed. Now, Jack Taylor and I have talked a great deal about this, and after this real bottoming out that happened in my own life, We went over to San Antonio, and I worked with Jack on his staff for about 3 months before returning to West Memorial to pastorate again. And during that time, Jack said, "Ralph, it took me 5 years of teaching the same thing Sunday after Sunday from the pulpit before my people began to understand what I was talking about." And he paid that kind of a price because he knew who had started it in the first place. And the renewing of Castle Hills Church was a 7-year process for Jack Taylor. My friend, when you take people who in all of the years they have lived, in all of their past experiences, that have gone into the memory computer bank, that's the only thing they have to draw from when you begin to talk about something new in the future. Now remember that we are the sum total of all our yesterdays. And if I try to describe to you what eating durian is like, there is no way that you have anything in your past experience, unless you've lived in Southeast Asia, to even equip you for durian. It's not like any fruit or vegetable in the world, and it doesn't smell like anything except an outhouse, and it doesn't taste like anything but fine English custard eaten in an outhouse, and it is the most unusual, unique fruit in the world. But if I came in here and I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, let me give you 2 scripture verses why you ought to be a durian lover. Now bring it in, bring the axe, and let's begin to chip them open. And each of you take one of these creamy pods that has a seed in the middle and just suck it into your mouth," we'd have people throwing up all over the floor. And I'm not trying to be smart. I'm just trying to be graphic because, friend, when you try to take people into something that they have no conception of, and take your face off and turn your face around and put it in front of their face and say, "Try it, you'll like it." And your face is smiling back at you because you've been reading Gordon Cosby and you've been doing this and that and you've been away at this renewal conference and you've been up here this week and you've gotten all these new exciting ideas and, oh, you got to go back and try it. And you take that off your face and turn it around and put it on the face of some deacon who's never been out of South Georgia in his life. You are getting ready to get your head shot off. And it was a painful time. We've got a precious lady sitting on the back row who called me one day on the telephone when we'd gone through all this trauma, and this quiet little voice on the other end of the line said, "Ralph, will you come back?" And as long as I live, I'll never forget that voice on that phone. Nor will my love for that sister ever wane. But out of that, dear friends, let me just share these things that I believe in very deeply. And I have just been through 3 years in Singapore in which we didn't blow anything apart. We didn't lose a single person. We took 1,517 Chinese people, and we went through the most radical change that they've ever known in the history of their work in Southeast Asia, and we did it successfully. So I can tell you how not to do it. I'm an expert on that. And I can also tell you that I have done successfully the things that are here and that they will work. Okay. Who started it? God started it. What is the theology behind it? Present that theology carefully until you begin to get feedback. Not, don't just speak it, but present it until you begin to get feedback. That feedback can be verbal or nonverbal. But until you know the concepts have been clearly planted in the hearts of those that are going to be affected by it, don't move on. And then remember this. You can differ widely, but not wildly. Now, if you go to people who live in a world of circles and you say, "Here is a square," they don't have anything that they can attach that to. Now, right now at West Memorial, we are proposing what is a rather significant change in our lifestyle. We're going to go to mini churches or miniature congregations within a major congregation dispersed out into neighborhoods. And the concept of a lay pastor is going to be very important to us. Now, this could look like this, except for one thing. Here in our circle, we already have a diaconate. And those deacons, although many of them are not adequately functioning, are already doing something like what a lay pastor over here will be doing in the mini church. They have a group of people, and they are the pastor to that group of people. They minister to those that are in this group. And so when I'm working on these materials here this week that we'll be using next week back in Houston, but when I present the concept of a lay pastor, I will say we might want to even go ahead and continue to call him a deacon because he is the shepherd of the flock. But he would be a deacon at a deeper level than the deacons that we now have, and he would have to undergo special doctrinal and practical training in order to effectively minister to this group in the neighborhood. So I try to find something here that I can bring over here so it doesn't be a wild, doesn't look like a wild, but a wide distinction. People can handle differing widely. They cannot handle differing wildly. So sometimes it's better to go through some intermediate steps. Always being sure that the Word of God, the theological foundation, is beneath what is being presented. And then the next thing is this. You're still sitting, you're still thinking, you're still praying at this point. You haven't started to work yet. You're just kind of projecting this thing out into the future. I would, after I get to the point where I've got my theology worked out and I know God is starting this, then I would ask myself, is the change really worth it? Is the change really worth it? I've been talking about buying a computer for my father's radio ministry that I'll be taking over one of these months in the future. He's on 68 radio stations in the United States and a bunch of them overseas, and he's got 2.5 women hand-doing all of the mail that comes in. And so I said to him, we ought to computerize this thing. And I worked out all of the plan for it and the flow charts for it. And I said, I can see where we'll eliminate 1.5 women just like that. One woman in the computer is all we need. I was talking to a young man who's a brilliant CPA that I'm trying to win to the Lord about this the other night in his home. And I said, we can save 1.5 women. He said, so what? I said, what do you mean? We can get rid of 1.5 women. He said, I'm not concerned, and if you're a smart businessman, you should not be concerned about how many women are going to be employed. The question is, will it save you enough money to do it? He said, it doesn't matter if you can do it twice as fast with half the labor if your cost at the end of the year is going to be identical. He said, why go through all of the agony you're going to go through trying to take 35,000 names and put them on stream on a computer if at the end of the year you're not going to save more than $100 or $200 by doing it? He said, it's not always smart just to switch over. And oh, I went home and I thought to myself, isn't that an important principle in the matter of change? If when you get done, you got a new, different system, and it really won't produce anything that the old system won't produce, then it's not worth it. Change for the sake of change alone is absurd and is done only by those who are ignorant. So the question is, what really will be the dividend of doing this? Whether it's in discipling people, winning people to Christ, developing a stronger church or whatever. All right, the next thing is this. Anticipate the people who will be most influenced by this change. First by categories and then by names within the categories. Now, all groups of people will divide into three parts. You have creative people. You have mimics. And you have traditionalists. Now, a creative person is an individual who can see something in a vision in a dream. You can sit down, you can talk to them. You can be riding along in the car and say, hey, let me give you the structure of something, blah, 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 blah. And he sits there, and while you're talking about it, he's helping you build it. And when you get done, he says, yeah, that's great, let's go. And they're going to represent about 5% of the total in any group. And then they're going to be the mimics. You sit down, you do the same thing with a mimic, blah, 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 blah. And he says, well, I wouldn't oppose you on it, but I don't really understand that. And you try to explain it, and their eyes get glassy, and you know they're not going to understand it either. But I want to tell you something about the mimic. You give the mimic a model, you show him something that is either exactly like or similar to what you're talking about, and let him see it operating, let it see it activating, and he will do something for you that the creative person won't do. The creative person, by his very nature, after he has created it, will be moving on. Because that's the way God made him. He's constantly generating. And the mimic can't possibly generate anything. God didn't make him to be a generator. But I'll tell you, he sure as shooting can step in and build 100 models just like the first one he saw and have fun doing it. You ask me to build 100 houses as a carpenter, I go crazy. You ask me to build one house, a cottage somewhere for myself, would be a challenge. So when I got done with it, no thanks, no more houses for Uncle Ralph. But a mimic will be probably 60% of your people. And then you're going to have another group of people, and I'm not going to make this come out 100%, but you're going to have some people who are like that 90-year-old man the young pastor went to visit his first week in the new pulpit, and he said, sir, I understand you are 90 years old. That's right. And you've been a church, you remember this church since you were 10. That's right. And in these last 80 years, sir, I'm sure in the church you've seen many changes. Yeah, and I've been agin every one of them, too. And they're going to be there. And the best thing to do with them is let them alone and leave a place for them. And don't try to take their place away from them. Let them go on forever. So your change can never be so radical that you're going to completely obliterate their place. Now, when you start differing wildly, you're going to destroy the place of the traditionalist. And when you back a tiger into a corner and you don't give him any other place to go, he's going to come right down your throat. And a traditionalist can really be a tiger. So that is really important. Now, I anticipate those most influenced by the change and then ask the question again, is the change worth it? Is it really worth it to take these people through this? Then list all of the advantages and all of the disadvantages that you can think of that will be related to this. Don't do it in one sitting. Do it over a period of time. What are the disadvantages of doing this? And if you can't answer every one to your own satisfaction, it's time to begin to think about either postponing or aborting for the present. Then four, forecast the time you think it will be, forecast the time needed to take people through the change and then double it. Because it's going to take a lot longer than you think. The slower you go, the better. Five, bounce your idea off a few trusted friends who walk with God. And then listen to them and revise as you go. When you've gone all that distance, then sit down and write out what could be a presentation of it. Maybe 20 minutes long. Maybe with charts and diagrams. Whatever you think it would take, consider that you're going to present this to the traditionalists and to the mimics. And write out what you'd say to them. And then let it get good and cold on your desk for a few days or a week. And then come back and look at it again and revise it. 7. That's 7 in my book. It's probably 12 in yours, not to worry. Choose the time to present this new concept. If my son wants to borrow a dollar, the best time is right after supper. Not just before supper. What is the best time to present this concept? Would it be in the middle of the Easter season, or when the choir is rehearsing? In the middle of Christmas season, when people are very busy? When is the best time to present this, and how will you do it? If the idea is an important idea, the preparation ought to be thorough, and the presentation ought to be really effective. We have just now gone to this point in something that I have been praying about for a number of years overseas. We presented a multimedia called The People Who Care 1987. We worked on a stereo soundtrack, 32-minute long multimedia, using either 7 or 8 projectors, I can't remember which, in stereo sound, 5 screens. And we presented the concept of the gathered, scattered church the last Saturday night in September in a banquet for the congregation. We had a wonderful, wonderful time, and we had a very positive response. Now, 8, propose the major points like empty baskets. Take your major points and propose them like empty baskets. Don't put anything in it. Don't put too many of the details in it. And the reason for that is this. Any human being on the face of the earth thinks this way. My plans are good plans. I thought of them. Your plans are bad plans, because they're not my plans. Our plans are great plans. And an effective change agent is one who will say, here's an empty basket. And the first thing we need to do is talk about baskets. Do you like the basket? Never mind what's in it. How about the basket? What do you think? Do you like that kind of basket, or would you rather have a square one or no basket at all? And you deal with that first. And after you've dealt with that, and you know that those that are going to be affected by it say, well, okay, all right, we like the basket. Then say, all right, the basket's empty. Now what should we put in the basket? You decide what goes inside this basket. I don't. Because you're the ones that are going to be influenced by this, not me. And so you develop a process now of filling the baskets and stay out of it, stay as far out of it as you can, and never mind how it goes when it goes into the basket. It's not going to ever be exactly the way you thought it ought to be when you sat down and talked to your best friends about it, and it shouldn't be. Because the people that are going to be influenced by a change need to be the people who make the change with you. If they're not in on the creating of the change, they're not going to be committed to it. So, just now, we are getting ready to go into that. We have research groups. The major concept has been presented. Now we have a string of research groups. The concept of the mini church. The concept of worship. The concept of our youth ministry. The concept of many other things. There must be 8 or 9 different study groups, and they will study until December now. And small groups, and we've got nearly 100 of our 500 members, 562 members, that are involved in that. And that's a pretty good response. That's a lot more than I really expected. If I can get 10% of any congregation to get excited about anything, I'm pretty happy about it. Because that's just the way people are strung out in their pilgrimage. So then, let the initial adoption of the major points come quickly. When you make your initial proposal and you propose the empty baskets, let the adoption come quickly. If it doesn't come quickly, you did not do step one properly. Return to step one and start all over. Step one is theology breeds methodology. And if you've not given a proper theological base, you've taken your people too fast and they're not ready for it. And this is the critical path in all of this. And it's where I'm going to mess up over and over and over again if God it does not spare my simple mind. So, the initial adoption then, if the people are aware of the value of it and the purpose of it, the initial adoption should come quickly and there should not be strong opposition. Will you have no opposition? Why, the traditionals will murmur. Never mind. Assure them that they will not be destroyed by this, that you're not going to take that ladies' class away or whatever, and go on. And then, this is something that I've never read in a book, but I really, really believe in. At this point, when the enthusiasm is high, when everybody is excited, when the banquet is over, let it cool off. Let it get ice cold. Don't organize those study groups in the next 7 days. Let it cool down. Why? Can you think of two or three reasons why I would say that?
As a greater percent of failure.
Pardon?
You won't have as large a percentage of dropouts.
Yes, you're not going to have people signing up in enthusiasm who will regret it later. That's one important reason. Can you think of another one?
Let them think about it more.
Well, give them a chance to brood on it. Can you think of another one?
They need time to pray about it.
They need time to really think and pray about it. There's another very important reason. It has to do with these people right here.
Traditional see that there's some other people excited about it, they'll be given time and they'll come over to your side a little slower, but they might come.
If you move like the wind, the traditional says, what in the world is going on here? This is going so fast, it scares me. But the traditional person has an opportunity to see that empty basket and nothing is happening and the world is not exploding and going up in smoke. And he recognizes that this will not be the most devastating crisis that ever happened. So you just let it lay. And let it get cold. And let the enthusiasm that is temporary fade. And let the traditionalists know that you as a change agent are not trying to move like lightning and destroy his world. And so you deliberately let it grow cold. Now, it's been since the end of September, since we had our banquet called the Night of the Dream. And this is the 1st of November. And I have yet to organize those study groups. And a few have said, when are we going to get going? And the staff is hearing it more than I am. All right, we're ready to go. But I didn't want to move quickly. Now, in Singapore, where we had a whole Baptist denomination, there are 11 churches over there, and since 1951, they hadn't changed a thing, not even the position of a piano. I made the proposal in June, and I didn't crank it up again until October. July, August, September. I let 90 days go by and really let it get cold before I came back again. And I've never seen this in a book, but I just really think it's important. And during that time it's cooling off, my friend, you stay on your knees before God. And let God teach you. And think about it and mull it over. And consider all of the possibilities. And get yourself ready. for the fact that it's not going to come out the way you thought it would, and it shouldn't, because it can't be your program. If it's God's program, the body of Jesus Christ will together be led to it, and if it's one man's program, it's not a body life ministry in the first place. And then next, allow all to be affected to have a chance to share in filling the baskets. The traditional people, the mimics, the creative people alike. Your traditionalists will not participate in all probability. They'll have nothing at all to do with it. But your mimics and your creative people will. And allow them to fill those baskets and stay out of it as much as you can. Don't manipulate. And then next, be prepared to adjust or compromise. Be prepared to adjust or compromise. And next, anticipate serendipities. Anticipate serendipities. It may well be that in these study groups, as they begin to meet and share their hearts and lives together, that God will give them an excitement and a vision of their own as they begin to move around inside of one of those baskets. And it could be that it'll change things around a lot or a little. But if a serendipity comes, don't smash it. Don't say, as the change agent, it's got to be exactly the way I set it up or I'll have nothing to do with it. When you find that spark of excitement or enthusiasm coming within one of the areas, turn those people loose and just keep firing the question at them and just keep hitting them again. Who started this serendipity? Did you start it or did God start it? Have you discovered this on your knees? Is this from the Lord? And if there's any doubt, say, okay, let's have some prayer meetings about it. But if it's from the Lord, then recognize that it may bend the steel a little bit, but it's going to be exciting. Then let the total group adopt. Let the total group adopt. Then take the most creative people you have and develop a model. Take your most creative people, you may throw in a few mimics, and develop a model, a working model, something that can be seen, something that the mimics can look at and say, oh, I couldn't figure it out when it was a vision, but now that it's down here and it's working, I can see it. And you know what? When the model gets going, you're going to say to yourself, this really isn't what I had in mind at all in the first place. And this is a far cry from the perfection I anticipated. And that's when the Lord's going to say, yeah, and I'm sandpapering you a little bit too. And your ego is going to die a little more because it needs to die. Because this really isn't ever going to be something you can call your program. It's something that God's doing through the body. And you are just an agent to make it happen. But once the model is developed, next, adjust as you go. Adjust as you go. It is only when you begin to work in the model that you're going to find bugs you never dreamed would be there until you got started. So there has to be continual readjustment. Next, let those in the model be the ones who sell it for you. Get in the background and stay there. And if the people who are actually in your working model are not committed enough and excited enough about it to share it with the rest of the group that need to be led later on into it, if you can't get the people that are doing it and excited enough about it to recommend it to others, then it's time to just let it fall flat on its face and die. Because if the only thing going is you're pushing, it's not of the body and it's not going to be something that will stick around. And then transition those who are now ready. One step before that. Evaluate thoroughly before you transition the whole group into it. Evaluate thoroughly. And your evaluating team ought to have at least one traditionalist on it. And a lot of mimics. And a couple of creative people to help find the answers when the traditionalists throw up the problems. But there needs to be a good, solid evaluation. Anything that happens ought to have a time to evaluate. Then make the transition and leave the old around for those who cannot change And don't ridicule them. Love them. And leave them alone. Leave them alone. And then, finally, establish a permanent training system so all newcomers entering the group will be properly oriented to the new pattern. Establish a permanent training for all newcomers so they will be oriented in the new pattern. Now, regardless of how large or how small the change is, there's a general umbrella here that we have looked at, and the larger the change, the more important it is to go through all these steps. The smaller the change, you can throw lots of them together and shortcut it. Okay, questions?
What's the status of West Memorial now?
It's the greatest church in the world. My apologies to my friend Brother Seaborn, but he can't possibly be pastoring the greatest church in the world. I also have the greatest wife in the world, if that'll help you understand what I mean. I'm just deeply in love with West Memorial, and right now we are going through this transition period, and we're moving toward a mini-church concept where we will have cells in the congregation that will be established by neighborhoods, and from their own base, they will equip and evangelize in the neighborhood. They will have some form of their own gathering, whether it's a weekly worship service or a bi-monthly worship service. Each separate group will decide for themselves. We'll have an umbrella, a ministry for teenagers from all of the various groups, other things that will go along with it. The possibility is, I'm proposing the possibility of one worship service, perhaps 2.5 hours in length, so those who may live 1 hour and 15 minutes away can drive in once a week and yet be a very tightly knit group of ministers in their own area. We have a family from League City that drove in this past Sunday afternoon to talk about beginning a mini church in an area that will take at least 1 hour and 15 minutes to come back. I'm excited on the way up here about discovering that there is a videotaped lay theological training program available. I had been talking to the staff about our having to do this ourselves, and discover a man in Atlanta has already done it and already has the first 2 years of it ready. And so we can go to this mini church with a television set and a VTR, and we can provide a complete adult theological training right on the spot for an ongoing ministry to the Christians. So we're going through this, and right now we're in the transition time. We're just launching study groups. In December, each study group will come back with proposals. They'll have a 6-hour congregational meeting on New Year's Eve from 6 o'clock until midnight. And there we'll thrash out the actual lifestyle, and beginning the first of the year, we'll go into the testing of the mini churches with maybe 2 or 3 areas and keep the congregation informed while the rest of us go pretty well on in the same direction until we can evaluate the effectiveness of what the mini church does. Does it grow? Does it penetrate the neighborhoods? Is it something we ought to go into? Then later next year, after the evaluation and the presentation to the congregation, there'll be a final vote, yes we will or no we won't, and then we'll go on into it if the congregation feels that it's a wise idea. Yes?
Do you see yourself as personally involved in one of the models, or do you feel like you need to stay in the mainline structure and let other people control the models?
I can't really answer what I'm going to do on that yet. I can tell you what I'd like to do. What I'd like to do is not be involved in the model. I'd like to take the role from the beginning, but the reason I hesitate is I have a very strong feeling that I should never take someone where I have never been myself. I cannot be an effective leader if I haven't been there myself. And in the future, in the years to come, in the development of our staff, I see every person in our staff being someone who may be one to Christ, who comes into a mini church, who grows in the mini church, who becomes the shepherd of a mini church and knows that, and then moves on up to be the the supervisor of other shepherds? Because if you haven't been there, how can you lead someone?